I feel like when I published a book, there was a lot of like kind of coming out as a writer in a way, where it's like there had been this part of my life that had been a huge part of my life for a long time that a lot of people just didn't know about.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Tracy Rose Payton, author of the novel Night Wherever We Go, a novel focused on the interior lives and relationships of enslaved Black women who refuse to allow their bodies to be bound.
Writing about this particular period post the whole question of quote unquote slavery fatigue, I felt like I had to justify why this book needed to exist. So I think I felt this pressure to tell a bunch of stories that I felt were underexplored or I felt like we hadn't heard.
In telling new stories about an old history, Tracy spent years researching the novel as well as developing her skill as a storyteller. The personal fear she had to face to break the book open and write honestly about the experiences of her characters. Plus, how slavery formed and informs the folklore of Texas, the setting for the novel. And the reason Tracy felt she had to hide her identity as a writer so much that colleagues thought she was in rehab. That and more is next, when Black and Published continues. All right, so let's jump in. Tracy, when did you know that you were a writer?
I think early on, I think I was always kind of interested in books, fascinated by books, like an early reader, all that. And I think most kids who are early reader, you're like, oh, cool, I want to figure out how to do this. And then you say to your parents, oh, I want to be a writer. And they're like, writer, starve, pick something else. I think especially Black folks in Chicago are like, that's cute. But
Southside all day. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Do something else. So I feel like that was a common experience for a lot of us where it's like, oh, yeah, I want to do this thing, but it can't be a real thing, but it can be a thing that I love while I figure out how to do something else.
So when did you decide, you know, even though I may have to go get this real job, I still want to try to write this book?
I feel like that was a long journey. And I don't know why, for some reason, I thought, again, because I needed to have real skills. When I went to college, I studied film. And my parents were like, that's not real either. And I was like, well, there are a lot of jobs. Like, you know, when you look at the credits at the end of a movie, there are like 100 jobs.
A lot of jobs.
That's a lot of jobs.
A lot of jobs.
You know, so.
I never thought of it that way.
But yeah, I think I was for a long time trying to figure out other ways to figure out how to tell stories, like photography, film, like here are all these other ways that you can do some version of this thing that you want to do that people say is a safer way to do it or a more economically feasible way to do it. So I think for a long time, I was trying to figure out that while still kind of writing on the side or writing in bits and pieces. And I would probably say maybe one of the fundamental, pieces of my journey, I would say probably when I was a kid, like I probably like everyone I did does that thing, I think, where you're like 11 and 12, you're like, I'm going to write a novel. And and I remember a friend and I, who were both readers, decided we were going to write this novel together. And it was interesting because of all the books that we read at the time, we didn't see any books that, you know, were girls that looked like us, which was just like, okay, Black girl with pressed hair. Again, and the things I'm reading, of course, are like Babysitter's Club and the Wakefield Twins, and they're like all these like fluffy books about school rivalries and disappointing your parents in like really PG ways. And I think all the books that I feel like of the few books that existed at the time about young Black girls were always like tragedies. They were always like abject poverty, violent sexual abuse, just like super, super, super dark, tragic stories. And so I think I always think it's interesting that when we first started to write these stories and try to write about people that look like us, we didn't know how to do that. We felt like there was no way forward. So we wrote about blonde girls who were in love with boys named Blake and who were on the cheerleading team, you know, just whatever, because it's like those were the things we were reading. And so I think a large part of my journey has been trying to figure out like how to write our stories and like how do we write our stories, how to write about people that look like us in the communities that we come from. How do we write about Black institution building? How do we write about all these things that matter that are all the different pieces of who we are, even if we don't necessarily see them out there represented in the way that we think they should be?
I wonder, did you ever feel like you were hiding your writing or your want to be a writer by doing it on the side in this like secretive way where you're trying to tell these stories of Black women and girls, but no one believes that you can make it. So then you like just keep it to yourself and not share.
Even when I published the book, I feel like I was coming out of the closet in a way, if that makes any sense, where it's like, because I worked in advertising for a long time. And I remember I had first started to do like writing residencies and do the whole thing. And I had taken a break and I had a really like a couple of kind bosses who really let me like, you know, take a month off and go do a writing residency. And of course, I didn't tell my coworkers where I was going because that doesn't make any sense to people. And so I just said, oh, I'm just taking, you know, I'm taking time off, blah, blah, blah. And a coworker of mine who he said that when I came back, everyone thought I was in rehab. Because of course, like if you are a regular person with a job again, and there's no, and you're not saying that there's like some tragic thing where it's like, you know, someone's sick or someone's ill or you're having a baby. Like people don't have any kind of context for, well, I'm going to take some time off and like work on a book. They're like, what are you doing? So I feel like when I published a book, there was a lot of like kind of coming out as a writer in a way where it's like there had been this part of my life that had been a huge part of my life for a long time that a lot of people just didn't know about.
Were you always, as you were taking the time to hone your skill and your craft by doing residencies, was it always working on what became Night Wherever We Go?
At the time, yeah, for sure. Because this book has been with me for about a decade, I would say. Maybe a little longer. Because I think when I first came across the anecdote that to me, that is like kind of the cornerstone of the book, I didn't know how to write a novel yet. Hadn't really written a lot of short stories yet. I didn't have, my craft level wasn't there. So it took a long time to get to the point where I could tell the story in the way that I wanted to and do it the justice that I felt like it deserved. And I think part of that also when you're doing it on the side and you're like working full time and going through all the different iterations of what that looks like in in corporate America and in different like particularly tough cities. Like I lived in New York for like a decade, which is, you know, can be a tough city to like make a living in. And that has a big effect on like, you know, your productivity at different points.
You said, what was the cornerstone of the novel? You cut out a bit.
Yeah. To me, the cornerstone of the novel is there's an anecdote in Paula Gidding's Social History, When and Where I Enter, which is basically a social history about Black women in America. And she has one chapter on slavery and resistance. And in that chapter is where she talks about this one story of this group of women on a plantation, most likely in Tennessee, who controlled the birth rate on their farm for like 20 years. So even when their master would swap out one of the women and try to create more fertility, the pregnancies never lasted more than like 4 or 5 months. I think only one or two children were born within like a 20-year period. And they found out at the end that there was an old woman who was giving them a quote-unquote remedy, an herbal remedy. And we know the story because it was at a medical journal, medical conference, where a lot of doctors were meeting to talk about this problem of like enslaved women's fertility and how they, you know, things that they needed to be aware of. These women are wily and blah, blah, blah. So I first read that anecdote in her book and I was like, that's a fucking novel. Like, I'm not ready to write it. I don't have the skill to write that yet, but that's a novel.
And I would say probably was and is.
And I'll probably say some of that comes from, I studied film at Howard and was reared by Black filmmakers who were very focused on Black resistance and not just how we tell our stories, but like what are the, and a lot of times like we're thinking about like overt resistance, but I think that was the thing I was really interested in this story because it's not the resistance that we normally think about. It's covert resistance, it's quiet, it's not necessarily Gabriel Prosser or Nat Turner. But it is the ways that women were employing the tools that they had to resist in the ways that were most important to them. And that's the thing I think that's really inspiring to me about like that anecdote, but also just reading around it and reading the other stories of women who were just like, yeah, I'm not having children until emancipation. Like, I'm not doing it. I'm not bringing children into this. And yeah, so that just was like mind blowing when I first read it. And I still was just like, I still haven't seen that story anywhere. I have to figure out how to do it.
The only place I had seen it before your book was in a Twitter thread. And I don't even remember who posted it because it was this whole deep dive about cotton root. And I went down the entire rabbit hole and I was like, what? And so then when I read your book, I was like, oh, sis was deep into the knowledge, like all of the conjure and the hoodoo and the plants and the herbs and then the one character talking to trees. I told you when I emailed you back to schedule this interview, I was like, my God, the research. What was the research process like? Because I was like, I could never.
It was definitely a long process of research. But I will say, like, in some ways to me, it's almost two halves, right? Because I had written a draft of this novel while I was kind of working in advertising in New York and reading what I could get my hands on and like what I could get through, I don't want to say traditional channels, but you know, that's part of the reason I went back to grad school, because I was just like, one, A, I need more time, but B, I need another level of research than what I currently have access to. I'm very fortunate to have written this book at a time when scholars are doing such amazing work. I feel like one of the other books that I often mention as a foundation is Stephanie Camp's book, Closer to Freedom, Enslaved Women in Everyday Resistance in the Plantation South. She's the person who writes a lot about the frolics and like the parties that enslaved folks would have and like what type of things would happen there. And like, and that thing was like, I was like, I had never seen that before. That's a novel. Like, what are the things that we do when we're together? And I think to me, that foundation comes from, again, the question that Boris is often talking about, or often I think kind of advising those of us who want to do this work, is that the story is not, I feel like sometimes people get lost where the story is often like about our particular quote unquote battle with oppression or our battle with white people. And it's like, yeah, that's one portion of the story. The story really is how we deal with each other and how we communicate with each other and what the stresses of these systems do to our relationships with each other. And I feel like looking at those spaces, I think what's the department says, right? Looking at those spaces allows us to explore that and not be always concerned with like, you know, telling the particular story of like us versus white people or whatever that is.
Once you had all of those different jumping off points together in the research, what was it like when you finished like your first draft and felt like you were ready to go forward? Or more than a first draft. A third, a fourth draft, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on it for a couple of years, wrote an ending, was revising it, thought I was about ready. I went to Tin House and did like a whatever the week-long workshop is. And it's like, even in that workshop, you're only reading the first two chapters, maybe, of the book. But I had an instructor there who read the first two chapters, and then like he had a conference, we had a conference, and he said, tell me what your novel's about. And so I told him, and he was like, that's amazing. Basically, these two chapters, that's not what I thought your novel was about. And when I digested what he had to say, what I realized was that that draft of the novel, all the scary stuff was in the background of the novel. None of that was in the front. So like all the stuff where it's like, I was still scared to write about rape. I was still scared to write about like what actual forced reproduction looked like. So I think there was a lot of stuff in the front around like maybe the forced marriages and whatever, but there was a lot of stuff that was like not there. And so that taught me, I was like, okay, you need to break this. You need to like break it and start over. And so in grad school, that's when I kind of like basically started the novel over. And from that point, I would say it was probably during a pandemic that I had like kind of hit the point where I was like, okay, I think this is here. We're pretty darn close to like the thing I want it to be and the thing I imagine it to be. And that was terrifying.
Then what has the publication process and journey been like before this unsettling experience of it's out and so now what?
It's tricky because it's hard to say. Like I would say I went out during the pandemic, I think, to, and this is the again, also the benefits of grad school is that your professors know people and people come to the program. So I met the person who became my agent. I met him at the program. And so when I was ready, I think I sent him the novel. And he was interested, and I think I went with him. And then I think he asked for, I think I did one round of revisions with him. And then we went out September. And then I think we sold, I think within a few weeks. So Echo made a preempt, and then worked with my editor, did two rounds, I think, and came out this January.
What has the reception been, given the climate that we're now in around books, around reproductive freedom? And all these things that you touch on in this book that are supposed to be relics of history, but are still living with us in the very present day?
It's been interesting because I think right around the time I came out, there would be initial questions around like the question of like Roe and the relevance of that. And the thing I typically say, it's funny though, I feel like I haven't had a lot of conversations about that since, to be honest. Probably because there's been so much going on. But I think the thing I say about it in terms of like, is that I think the thing to me, it reminds me, and I hope it reminds readers, is that women have been fighting these battles for a long time, and that some of the tools that our ancestors would use are tools that are still of use to us, right? So the question of going to your community doula or going to your community birth worker and having a birth worker, it's that thing about how like these vital practices sustained us and they were there for a reason. And I think we've seen the effect of like not having them, what it means when our quote unquote granny midwives are not part, whatever, we're forced out of the system, and like what that has looked like for a maternal mortality rate in Black communities. And now looking at this other new kind of aspect of what's happening with reproductive rights. So all of it's a long, long, terrible through line, but it's that thing about understanding the past so we're not forced to repeat it.
So with that said, let's get into your book that deals with the past. If you could read a little bit from it, and then we can dive all the way in. Because I, too, have a thought about the first chapter and then where we ended at the very end. And I was like, not the same book. Tracy Rose Payton's debut novel, Night Wherever We Go, follows the lives of six enslaved women on a struggling plantation in Texas. When their owners, the Lucys, nicknamed after Lucifer himself, come up with a plan to increase their prosperity through reproduction, the women refuse, choosing to honor their own lives, loves, marriages, bodies, and other children, despite the consequences of such open rebellion. Here's Tracy.
All right, I'm just going to read a paragraph from the first chapter. When we became we, Texas country was still new, only a few years old in the Union. Navarro County was known as a land of wheat with dreams of cotton. Corn was a sure business, but men like Mr. Lucy came to Texas with cotton on the brain and dragged us along to make sure the land would yield. He had been unlucky before, we knew from Junie, because she had been with the Lucys the longest. She had worked for Mrs. Lucy before she was a Mrs., then was carried off to Wilkes County, Georgia, where she worked field after working on field as the couple's debt grew and grew. And she told us how they packed up and left in the dead of night to outwit angry creditors that threatened to seize what little he had left. By then, all Mr. Lucy had between him and sure ruin was 30 worthless acres and three slaves. They took to the road in two wagons stuffed to the gills with furniture, clothes, crockery, and seeds, the Lucys fighting all the while, their two small children screaming in fits. Harlow droned on about a vision from God, about a land of plenty, while his wife called him a fool with foolish ways, her pitch increasing with every mud hole, every windstorm, every feverish river of dirty water. God's favor would surely shine upon them, Harlow assured her. But when their two male slaves were seized and held at the trader's office in New Orleans for outstanding debts, Junie wondered if Lizzie was right all along. She knew she had only been spared a place in the trader's pen because on paper, Junie belonged to Lizzie, a dower slave held in trust for Lizzie's children.
But like, I remember reading the flap copy and I was like, okay, I think I know what this is about. And then you introduce the women and then you introduce the stockmen from the flap copy. But then about a quarter into the book, all that goes away and it becomes something else entirely. And I was like, I thought we was just going to deal with this part and not all of this. And by all of this, I mean, it's not just forced rape from a breeder. It's not just slavery. It's the interior lives of these women who are enslaved and are forced to reckon, like today, with the patriarchy and the white supremacy, while also trying to maintain their own, not only bodily autonomy, but just personal autonomy. And I was just like, I wasn't expecting all of that. So you talked earlier about having to break the book after you got that first note. In the published version that we have, was it intentional to kind of like ease into everything that you wanted to say once you knew that you had to go deeper than what you originally had?
Maybe. I mean, I think, and Morrison does go to this, where it's like, I think of like, a novel allows us to tell many, many stories. And even in early drafts, I think like one of the things I was scared of was dealing with motherhood in the book because I'm not a mother. And then I was like, you can't talk about this without talking about motherhood. You can't talk about this without talking about the grief and the loss of having children that you're not able, that you are not allowed to like raise and mother in the way that you want to. The particular tragedy of losing children under enslavement. Like, there were just so many layers that I was just like, there are all these things that are part of this that you have to like be willing to kind of like walk into the fire with in order to just do justice to the subject. I think also too, it's writing about this particular period post the whole question of quote unquote slavery fatigue, I felt like I had to justify why this book needed to exist. So I felt this pressure to tell a bunch of stories that I felt were underexplored or I felt like we hadn't heard. So not just talk about reproduction, but also talk about Texas, which is something we don't necessarily think of as part of the story of American slavery. To talk about what the historian Tara Hunter calls mixed status marriages, where if you are married to someone with a different level of freedom than you have, if you're married to someone who is quote unquote free and you're not, like, what does that look like? And how does that affect your marriage? Which I think we deal with patience in the book, where her husband is quote unquote a free man, sort of. And so
there's a couple of ways in the book, all of those different levels of freedom, enslavement, trying to navigate that, even with where you live in the South. And I don't think I've ever read a novel about slavery where it's not let's run north, let's go south to the border and hit Mexico right fast. And I was like, oh, that is also an option. Mm-hmm. Never mm-hmm. even considered it. And I guess from learning that that was also a route, how did that open your mind to the ways that Black people, no matter where they were or what station they had, continued to resist and rebel?
I went to Texas for grad school, and then I just got inspired by Texas because it's such a strange, I shouldn't say strange, it's such an interesting place.
You can say strange. I lived in Texas for a little bit. It's strange.
Yeah. I mean, Texas has a very interesting, I would say as an outsider, Texas to me, it was strange just because it's interesting to live in a place, but they're very enamored with the lore of Texas. They're very enamored with their history. That 7 years of independence really lives for them. That 7 years of the existence of their own state of the country really lives for them. And I got really interested in why slavery is a big part of the Texas story, and we never think of it as that. And that as the more I was researching, slavery is foundational. It's a core part of why Texas is Texas. It's a core part of the beginning of the Austin colony and why they moved there, and they moved there to create more of an empire, more space for plantations. And they had got permission from the Mexican government to live there and start a colony. And the Mexican government said, cool, you can do that, but no slavery. And they said, well, what about indentured slaves? People who are indentured for 99 years. They were like, no. And the whole battle of what happens in terms of like Austin colony, from Austin colony becoming that to Texas becoming part of the Union, is all about slavery. And then I read that and I was just like, that is amazing. And why did I never know that before? And that feels like a foundational part of understanding a story that I want to tell, but also thinking about that if there's a whole question with scholars about how quote unquote common slave breeding was. But if it was common, it makes sense that it would be more common in Texas, mainly because of just where Texas was evolving at the latter half of when the Atlantic slave trade closed, like in 1808. So like this part of Texas is like, you know, 1830s, 1840s. At that point, the trade is closed. Now all of it is domestic movement of enslaved people from the Upper South to the Lower South. Also because you had this whole particular weird history too of like smuggled Africans who were smuggled into Texas, again, post this trade. So like they had a whole population of African born enslaved people in a way that where that wasn't happening in the rest of the country at that point anymore. So you had all these interesting things happening in Texas, plus just the nexus of like what was happening with Mexicans and Tejanos and like what was happening with Native Americans. And so you just have like the history of it. It's wild. It's super interesting. And I found Texas super inspiring and Texas super interesting as a place. And just trying to think about the stories of Black folks in it. And I was just like, why don't I know any stories about Black people here?
In elucidating all of these different ways of resistance and rebellion, from running south for freedom to chewing cotton root and herbs to stave off reproduction, there's also a heavy emphasis on religion and spirituality. And you incorporate various modes of religion. So there's one woman who is Catholic. There's another that was Muslim. Another who practices Ifa, another that's just, you know, doing hoodoo. And all of them respect those practices and then incorporate them in one way or another. Well, if this one's not working, let's try this one. If this one's not working, we're going to try this one. We're going to keep calling on somebody, okay? Why was it important to show how important spirituality was, especially in times of resistance?
Mm. I love that question. I think I was super interested in the diversity of spiritual practices, right? I think to me, part of the larger project, right, is that part of the stories of enslaved folks are often very flat. And so I was super interested in this idea of the diversity of spirit ways that people were practicing, whether that's, you know, hoodoo or some type of herbalism or even more kind of, you know, Christianity or not. But like, and then also just the ways that people would practice them in different ways. Like, I think all of us know, I think I've always been interested in that kind of texture in between, where like all of us, I think, especially those of us who have relatives down south who will be all day Christian, but also practice a little hoodoo, right? And so, yeah, I think I'm always interested in like, that tension that we are not just one thing. I think maybe two or three books that come to mind about like enslaved religion or the evolution of that. And one of the things they talked about was that for people, hoodoo was very practical for them. Hoodoo was practical magic. And like, there's some things you go to Jesus with, and the other things
you need right now today.
You need, yeah. You know what I mean? Or you might pray on it and
right. I'm going to pray on it and I'm going to go get this here potion.
Right.
Right fast.
Potion. We're gonna light this candle. We're going to, you know, wrap this thing up, right? Whatever. Like, and I thought that was, and I just appreciated that. I just thought like, okay, it makes sense that like there are all these ways in which you are trying to fight the things that are a lot of things that you're trying to deal with. And to me, it makes sense to me that you would like try to access all the sources that feel available to you. Somebody's gonna listen, maybe.
In having all of these different layers and these different, not quite, it's not a send-off, but like these different pockets of knowledge that are embedded within the novel. Did any of it scare you as you were writing and trying to weave it all together?
Yeah, in some ways, I think because like it can get overwhelming. And I think you're always trying to do that thing where the book feels lived in. You're not trying to necessarily, I'm not a historian. I'm not trying to like, this is not, you know, history 103, whatever. And so I still want people to enjoy the experience of reading it. I want people to take nuggets from it. And if there's things that they're like, oh, I didn't know that. I want to learn more about that. But mostly I want people just to feel that the experience was lived in it, that they get to walk into that space and feel it from an interior space and feel it from a, and most of it to me, I think also too, with some of the religion stuff, a lot of it, I feel like that I'm interested in a way of seeing, right? Like that if we come from a people who believe that the environment was alive, right? And that the trees are alive and that the plants can talk to me and that the plants can offer me help. That affects everything in terms of how you look at the world and how the bird outside your window is a sign or not a sign or any of those things. And so part of it to me, it was trying to embody a way of seeing that in some ways I think we've lost a little bit. At least I know I feel separate from that in a way that I think part of this book is a way of trying to get back to you.
I want to talk about the ending with this hymn, because I was reading the hymn and I'm reading the last lines of the book. And then, you know, I'm the kind of reader that reads from the dedication to the acknowledgement. So I get all in everybody's business. And in the acknowledgements, you talk about the hymn is untitled. Why did you want to send the women off singing in chorus and harmony where and that the one that wasn't with them could join in.
Ooh.
That's how I felt exactly,
yeah,
right there.
Ooh, I love it.
That's what you did.
It's funny because like I never had another ending, right? Like I knew there would be some tragedy in ending. I knew that in some ways was inevitable. But also the bond between them to me was so important. And even through all their little stuff with each other, that bond and that still being connected in the here and in the hereafter was the thing that kind of carried me through that. And like, I just felt like, yeah, we're still here, whether it's on, you know, whichever side of the earth or whichever side of the land of the dead or the land of the living, that cosmology that kind of comes back and forth in the book.
I want to ask about the role of both grief and greed, because I think they serve a similar function, especially for Junie. I think is how we have the ending that we have and the climax that we have. And it's just like, no. But those are such base emotions that they can color your judgment and your discernment and make you do or go after something that should be out of reach, but you think it's just within your grasp. And having that feeling of longing and yearning be so palpable in the Lucys, as well as in their enslaved property, what was it like for you to play with that emotion and what it would make people do as a motivation?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was really interested in desire a lot. And I think part of the ways, part of that I felt like early on, I felt like the challenge in writing like a group of women was making them distinct on the page. And I could make people very distinct based on their desire and what they wanted. And even, you know, from Junie's like deep hunger to be reunited with her children, or even like, you know, Sarah's like kind of foolish, kind of teenage kind of hunger to be with her love. And so, yeah, desire just became super important to me in that way, where it became this way to like illuminate everyone's kind of like, not just personality, but just off of the thing that's like, that's moving them, driving them. It's the thing that like, is the thing that they kind of hold dear. It's the thing that just gives us just a whole nother picture in terms of like, beyond the labor and all of the other kind of normal things that kind of color their day. So I think I was really interested in, and the same with the Lucys, I was really interested in this desire between the couple too, where it's like, part of I'm interested in puncturing this idea of like white mastery, right? Like this idea of, and I feel like the country is very good, or the US or whatever, or just Western literature is very good at telling you stories about white men as like masters of the universe. And it's deeply untrue.
Well, no, like you say that, and I think in your novel, Harlow could neither master the land, nor could he master the people that he enslaved. He couldn't master his wife. He was not the master of anything.
Of anything. And I think also part of the thing is like to read about, and also to read about the division between working class white farmers, and by white farmers who either quote unquote own slaves, and those who couldn't afford slaves but maybe own land and could rent slaves, you know, the distinction between them and the 1% was always this desire for more, and this desire that they could be more, they could have more, they could be like the 1%. And I think I always think that one of the biggest, you know, cons ever told was how, and we continue to see this right with Trump, is how the 1% kind of got white working class farmers on board, instead of them being, you know, populist and kind of dealing with like the clash. It was like, but no,
you're white.
You're supposed to be with us. You're supposed to have all of the whatever, like, all, you know, all of this is supposed to be yours. All of this, you know, should be yours. And if only if you just kind of stay with us, we'll just help you. We'll help you get there or whatever. And it's, you know, it's always a fool's errand. And it was important to me to not make the white people cartoons, to understand, because I think that the psychology of being a person who believes you can own other people is interesting. It's deeply interesting to me. And so understanding his own greed and his own tension with his wife, and I'll say some of that thinking comes from Stephanie Joan Rogers' book, They Were Her Property, where she writes a lot about white women's role in particular, where it's like a lot of times we're like, oh, they just maybe just managed a house. And it's like, no, they own property. They, you know, ran breastfeeding markets, and they, you know, like they had a lot of hands and a lot of different things. And so, her book kind of really illuminates that. But one of the things her book also illuminates is like the tension that you would have sometimes between couples who had different levels of property, whether if you have a woman who through dower, maybe she owns more than her husband, and the tensions of what that looked like. And so I thought that was really rich and interesting. It's like, well, we often don't think about that. We often don't think about like what the tensions between these couples, and that, you know, sometimes the ways in which white women had power that we often don't acknowledge, and that they often don't acknowledge. So all that to say, I think I was really interested in the desires of everyone in the book.
Given all that you cover in this book, just at a human level, what do you want readers to take from it?
I think understanding probably, I would say, maybe the long tail of some of these battles that we're looking at right now, which I guess with the banned books is just even battles to tell these stories and talk about these stories. But some of them, I think, in terms about race and reproduction and autonomy over one's body and oneself. And I think those things in particular, and I think a lot sometimes about how we're very quick to displace the role of history in our current battles and our current fights. Again, I think just in understanding the tale, understanding how we got here, I think it's key to understanding kind of what we're dealing with as far as like Roe, as far as maternal mortality, just so many things I think that are going on that I think understanding the past helps us to better equip ourselves and square up for the current situations that we face.
I don't know why when you said that, it just makes me think about the Montgomery brawl. It's the first thing that just popped in my mind. That's all I thought about. Not square up.
Square up, man. I feel like we at this point. Woo, shop.
All right. I want to switch to the speed round of the game before I let you go for the afternoon.
Okay.
I know the answer is going to be many, but try if you can. What is your favorite book?
Oh, Lord. I just finished reading Louise Erdős' The Night Watchman, and she's a beast regardless. But like, again, talk about someone who's like trying to like, how do we tell the stories about the long tail of history? How do we tell stories about our people? How do we tell stories about our language? Like, she's always doing that, but like, yeah, she's a beast.
Who is your favorite author?
I mean, I have to go with the GOAT. Morrison all day. I mean, there's so many, honestly, but I feel like she's the person who I feel like we're always writing in the wake of her legacy, the wake of like Toni Capambara, like the wake of those women.
What do you think is the best book to movie or TV show adaptation?
Even though I'm not sure it's true, but I'm going to say The Color Purple, and I'm going to stick with the original. I don't know what they're doing with the new one. Maybe it's great. I don't know. But but I think I'm gonna say that because I think that the two things remain distinct though for me in a way that like one does not feel like a carbon copy of the other. Like the book is a singular masterpiece. And then there's something else I really appreciate about that movie. And even though I'll be honest, I feel like because I've seen that movie so long ago and have seen it so many times, I cannot look at it as a like objective piece of art anymore. But there's something also something I appreciate about the two things feel distinct. Like it's distinct pieces of art, distinct contributions to the culture, the songs that Quincy Jones, you know, arranged and all of that stuff, like that Duke Joint scene. Like there are just so many things that feel like distinct things that the movie does, distinct from the book. And then the way in which that book is just like a fucking incantation. Like you just like read it, it swallows you whole and spits you out. And you're like, what the hell was that? How?
If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
In some ways, I've been doing what I'm doing now, which is trying to figure out how to write the next work. except without the question of like, oh, Tracy, you need to figure out a job. without that question hanging over my head. Where would I live? I'd probably travel more, of course. I feel like that's always the thing. And even though I want to be one of those people who's like, I'm going to leave the U.S. for good. I want to be one of those people who say that I'm probably not. Like my family's here. Our blood is here. Like I'm not. There's something I believe in that. There's something I still believe in that. Whatever that little piece of land that my grandfather owns and, you know, who's of course now passed, but owned in like Thomaston, Georgia. There's something I still believe about that space and that land and our connection to that land that I don't necessarily think Black people should see as fast as we seem to be willing to do so. That's another conversation, I guess. So probably, yeah, those things. Yeah.
Mm. Name three things on your bucket list.
Ooh, okay. Write a script that gets made. Go to Ghana because I just still have never been. So I just probably like I spend some time on the continent. Go to Ghana, go to Senegal, like go to South Africa, like spend some time on the continent, deep time on the continent. And third, probably have this is I don't know what to call it because I think it's like it may not be a very traditional thing, but like I think because I've moved a bunch of places, I have friends and family who are all over, kind of scattered, who've never been in one place because I've not gotten married. So I feel like the traditional ways you have things that bring all those people together are like weddings. And I think in lieu of that, like, how do you have some type of celebratory thing that brings all the people you love in one room?
A birthday. And,
you know, I feel like birthdays are, I don't know. I've never been a big birthday person. Maybe I should be one. So maybe a birthday or something, but like just some type of celebratory thing where I can pull people together from all the different aspects of my life and like have them share space. That just seems like it would be a beautiful thing to happen at some point in my life.
All right. What brings you joy?
Books, friends, too much wine.
Hey.
Good liquor on occasion.
I bought 3 bottles today. Not ashamed. What brings you peace?
Books probably bring me peace. I think I'm one of those people who, I forget this all the time, which sounds really silly, but I think I lose a sense of myself when I'm not reading. And I'm a little bit more unmoored if I'm not reading. And then I'm like, oh, why are you weird now? Like, why are you Scatterbrain. Oh, you probably should be reading. You probably are not, you know, nourishing yourself in the way that is important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So our game is called Rewriting the Classics. Ooh. Classic is however you define it.
Okay.
Name one book where you wished you would have been the author.
Julie Otsuka's Buddha in the Attic, which is a super short book. It's like the whole book is written in a wee. It's the story of Japanese pitcher brides coming to America in the 1940s. And it's fucking brilliant. It's one of those things where it's so fucking brilliant. You're just like, A, how, and B, if only I could do this. And the other brilliant thing I say about that book is that the thing that she does from a craft perspective that's amazing is that, so the we is the consistent Japanese pitcher brides who are, you know, kind of all written in this chorus way, but the they is constantly changing. So the they is the children, the they is the husbands, the they is the white people that they work for. Brilliant. Fucking brilliant.
Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
I'm going to say The English Patient. Because I can't think of anything else right now. He didn't have to kill the guy at the game. Like, that was unnecessary. Like, that was just unnecessary.
And then my messy question. Name one book you think is overrated or overtaught and why?
I don't get the Catcher in the Rye thing, fam. I don't get it.
I swear, I've done, you might be like my 14th interview for this season, and I feel like 12 of y'all have all said The Catcher in the Rye. Like, this is Shade the Catcher in the Rye season. If that's the only thing you get from Black and Published for season 4, it's we're shading The Catcher in the Rye, and it should come out of the canon.
It should come out of the canon.
Because I don't even think any of y'all know each other.
I didn't know that. I thought that was just a private opinion that I had. Yeah.
It is not.
Okay.
It is absolutely not. I think I had one guy say it in season 2, but it's been about 12 of y'all so far that have said, you know what? Catcher in the Rye, I could have done without it.
Couldn't done without it. Couldn't done without it. Yeah, couldn't done without it.
And I have never read it.
Yeah, don't. Then we all waste your time. There's too many great books to read. Do not read that. It's no. Nope. Could have done without it.
My final question for you today. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the legacy of words and work that you've left behind?
Ooh, child. Ooh, I feel like I want to figure out what the writer equivalent of what's the thing like we used to say in church, well done.
Well done, good and faithful servant.
Yeah. I feel like I want a writer equivalent of that, which is like I wrote books that were in the service of Black people, that Black people felt not only they saw themselves and felt like they were written for them. They didn't feel like I was translating. They didn't feel like I was writing for white people first and it was like they were an afterthought, but that like these books are about us. These books center our communities. They center our institutions. And they center the things that we grapple with each other, which I think is the important thing. I think that's that, to like have written in that tradition. Like there was a whole moment where, and I think people have moved away from this, where there were certain Black writers who did not want to be Black writers, right? Or didn't want to be deemed Black writers. They felt like it was limiting and they didn't want to be limited by such a thing and have their books only in African American literature and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, yeah, fam, no, the opposite, please. Like, put my books next to Morrison. Put my book next to Nikki Finney. Like, please. Like, to me, that is the goal. Like, for someone to think that my book or my work can stand on the shelf near, just near, like in the vicinity. Like it ain't got like again, like have those up there, but like just in the vicinity, like in the same wall.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like of those authors, to me is like the highest. That is, you know, the highest that I could aspire to, the highest, yes, the highest possibility. But yeah, I think it's just that every person who wrote the tradition in service of us.
Big thank you to Tracy Rose Payton for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Tracy's debut novel, Night Wherever We Go, out now from Echo Books. And if you're not following Tracy, check her out on the socials. She's at T Rose Payton on Twitter and Tracy Rose Payton on Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Tracy about the flexibility of spirit ways she found in her own family.
Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Roberto Carlos Garcia, author of the poetry anthology, What Can I Tell You?
And so the way that Latino or Latinx anti-Blackness manifests in those environments is wild, right? Because it comes with them from Latin America. It's not that they are indoctrinated here in the U.S. It's that they're bringing that anti-Blackness with them to the U.S. And you know, the U.S. is always willing to accept a willing participant in racism.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.